Traverse the Oceans with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to the 45th episode of Robots. Today we'll be talking about two incredible missions conducted with autonomous underwater vehicles. We first speak with Oscar Schofield from Rutgers University in the US about his fleet of gliders that can spend months at a time at sea and some of their amazing achievements like crossing the Atlantic Ocean.
We then go to biologist/engineer Mark Moline from the Center for Coastal Marine Sciences at Cal Poly State in California. He just came back from an expedition in the Arctic, where he used AUVs to discover that there is some agitated forms of life deep down in the cold.
Finally, before we wrap up the show, we speak with Kevin, a PhD student from Indiana University, about his personal definition of a robot to see if we can get closer to closing the debate. First, as always, let's hear this past week's robot news from Christine.
Thanks, Adam. Last month, California-based open-source robotics company Willow Garage issued a call for rigorous and creative research proposals involving their PR2 robot and announced a plan to make 10 PR2s available for free use. The call created quite a stir in the research community and resulted in an overwhelming volume of responses. Willow Garage received 120 letters of intent from universities, companies, robotics clubs, and hackerspaces from 27 countries on 5 different continents, with proposed programs covering areas from motion planning to multi-robot coordination and from education to elder care. The winning proposals will be announced after the call's final deadline on March 1st. But whoever wins, the incredible level of interest for this call promises a bright future for everyone working on open-source robotics. Researchers at the University of Illinois in the U.S. have developed an artificial version of the lateral line sense organ of fish to be used for underwater robots. The lateral sense organ, present in most fish, detects minute changes in water pressure to detect obstacles. It is thought to be particularly useful in situations where fish cannot rely on vision, such as in murky water or at large depths, and will also be useful to detect objects that are too close for sonar. The researchers hope that the new sensor will prevent future underwater vehicles from becoming trapped by unseen obstacles. Police in Taipei, Taiwan, report on two men using a remotely operated helicopter equipped with a camera to commit more than 10 burglaries. In what sounds quite similar to much current research on UAVs, the burglars used a low-noise helicopter to fly to the window of an apartment and send surveillance photos back to their computer. If the photos revealed there was no one in the apartment, the men would allegedly break in and carry out the burglary. Following the arrest of one man, police are still searching for the second burglar. For more information on Willow Garage's research proposal, an artificial version of the lateral line sense organ of fish, and Taipei's high-tech burglars, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Oscar Schofield is professor of biooptical oceanography at the Coastal Ocean Observation Lab, or COOL Lab, at Rutgers University. Schofield will tell us about the autonomous ocean gliders that the COOL Lab uses to explore the depths of the ocean for months at a time, mapping currents and collecting valuable data on our oceans. He also tells us about the Scarlet Knight, a fantastic little glider that managed to cross the Atlantic Ocean fully autonomously while dodging fishing nets, strong currents, and even the occasional shark.
Hi, Oscar. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes, I'm a professor of oceanography at Rutgers University. I'm a biological oceanographer, and I study how the biology of the ocean responds to changes in the physics and the chemistry.
You're a member of the Coastal Ocean Observation Lab, or the COOL Lab at Rutgers. Can you tell us a little bit about what your lab does? And what
yeah, so myself and Scott Glenn formed the COOL Lab. What the lab is, it's essentially a control center on campus that allows us to control oceanographic instruments and robots that are deployed all over the world. And so it's sort of a location where we can look at real-time data coming in from all over the world. We have students involved looking at the data and controlling the robots to study a range of scientific problems, both theoretical and applied. And so we're a pretty diverse, large group. We're about 25 people in the lab now, not including undergraduates, but we generally have up to 20 undergraduates working in the lab all year round. And we study questions such as, how does ocean circulation drive melting of sea ice in the Antarctic? We look at what are the physical features off the Northeast United States that regulate fisheries, and we apply all these new technologies to study those kinds of problems.
Speaking of technologies, what kind of technologies do you use? How do you gather information about the oceans?
Yeah, so there's you got to sort of think back to how we did it before. So when I was trained as a graduate student, I would go to sea on research vessels for months at a time. And essentially, you would hand collect the data. You would lower with a winch wire a small instrument, often not much larger than a pen, to collect sort of physical information and biological information about the ocean. And the problem with that is you can't be out there all the time. One, it's harsh, and you can't work in storms, which are important things to study. Two, it pretty much does hell to your family life. And then three, it's really expensive. Average research vessel out in the open ocean costs on the order of $20,000 a day. So you can't afford to be out there much. So what we focused on were these tools that allow us to be in the ocean essentially 365 days a year, 24/7. And the first two are satellites, satellite remote sensing. We'll give you large surface maps of the ocean, both physics and biology. We also make surface current maps using essentially radar systems that are mounted on shore and send out a radio signal, and we essentially track to what degree those waves that the sound is bouncing off move away from us or towards us, and we derive a current. And so those give you very broad spatial maps of the surface, and then we fill in underneath with these robotic Webb Slocum gliders is what they're called. But essentially they're underwater robots that are designed to last for long periods in the ocean without having to be picked up.
Oscar, can you tell us a little bit more about these robotic gliders that you use?
Yeah, so we use what's called a Slocum glider. It's named after Joshua Slocum, the first man to sail around the world by himself. And what these robots are is essentially they're a robot that they do not have a propeller. And their movement forward is based essentially on gravity. And what they do is they suck in about a coffee cup's worth of water into their nose, which changes their weight enough where they're just heavy enough to sink. They have wings and a tail rudder, which makes them fall in the forward direction as they sink. They reach the depths they want to go to. They push that water out with a pump, so now they're light, and they float up again in the forward direction. And so these robots essentially do a sawtooth pattern through the ocean underwater. And on the gliders is essentially a dedicated area with a computer and space for any science sensor I can fit on there. Some science sensors don't fit because the sensors are really big, but a large number of oceanographic sensors these days fits on the glider. And so the sensor is essentially recording data as the robot is moving up and down in a forward direction through the ocean. And what'll happen is it'll fly for some period of time. We can specify how long it is, and then it'll come to the surface. And when it reaches the surface, it essentially inflates a little bag in its butt and essentially calls our lab here in New Jersey. And we can take control of the robot when it's called in. It'll dump its data. It's collected to us so we can look at it throughout a whole mission. We don't have to sort of wait till we recover it to see what the robot's seeing. And we can look at the data and decide, okay, we want to change the mission. We want to go to a different place. And essentially then we'll download those commands to the robot and send it back on its way. And the beautiful thing about these systems is a traditional sort of autonomous underwater robot with a propeller typically lasts you on the order of hours to days, days being only a few classes. These gliders really last for months at a time. And so even though they move slowly because their only forward motion is really due to floating and sinking, they can cover thousands of kilometers, and you can control them the entire time. And that's what's really cool is with the Iridium communication system, I control these gliders everywhere. I have one today that is flying off Antarctica. It's near Avian Island in Marguerite Bay along the Antarctic Peninsula, and we're going to be directing it over the next week to fly into the British Antarctic Survey Base at Rothera. So you have a lot of control. You can be out there for a long period of time, and you can study a lot of things you couldn't from a ship. And so a good example is storms. If you've ever been to sea on a ship, in a big storm or a hurricane, the one thing you know is it's dangerous and it's miserable. And so we don't actually have much data about these events, even though we know they're fundamentally important for the physics and the biology. And so the gliders, though, don't get seasick. There's no safety issues. I mean, in the worst-case scenario, we lose a glider. But again, no one's hurt. No one's put in danger. And what's really amazing to me is we've flown in several hurricanes and nor'easters, we call them, storms here off the east coast of the United States. And the Iridium communication actually works fantastic during the storm itself. So we literally can be sitting at home and essentially logging in and seeing essentially real-time data from within the ocean during a large storm. And that's revolutionary compared to what we used to do.
You're right. We have actually covered AUVs before, and this really does seem like a completely other field. Can you put it into numbers for us, maybe? Tell us how big one of your gliders are, how much energy they use, for example, compared to an AUV, that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. So they're not very big. They're about 6 to 7 feet long. They're cylindrical, so they're essentially a long yellow tube, essentially pipe. On the front end of that pipe is essentially a nose cone, so it's rounded, and that's where water is sucked in. And we ballast it to the conditions we expect to find before we deploy them. So it literally is sucking in about a coffee cup's worth of water. That's what changes the buoyancy. The wings are very thin. They essentially just sort of clip on to the side of this long cylinder. On the back end, you have a tail. And the tail, in the top of the tail, it has a little, not dome, but a little disc. And that's actually essentially the global phone. So it gets that above the water, and we have communications, and it has a rudder. So they're very simple looking. They weigh about in air, depending on the sensor, you know, on the order of 100 to 150 pounds. And so another big advantage of these systems is you don't need a large ship to go deploy or recover. And so we do a lot of recoveries and deployments just from Zodiacs. And we lift it, just up on the edge of the boat, slide it in the water, and the same thing on recovery. We pull up to it in a Zodiac, we grab its tail, and we just hand pull it directly in the ship. And so you can essentially deploy them without large support vessels. In terms of power, I'm blanking on the absolute number, but the power is tiny, and that's sort of the strategy of using gliders. Essentially, it's the equivalent to, depending on your battery pack, 3 to 5 of those small Christmas lights is essentially your sort of power source. We use several different classes of battery. We use alkaline batteries. Essentially, it's a bunch of D cells that we just sort of have soldered together into packages. And I'd say when you look at a glider, maybe a third of that 6-foot body is just crammed full of batteries. The maybe, 20% of that is science sensors and computers, and the rest is sort of computer control boards for its various things it needs to control. The other types of batteries we use for longer missions are lithium-based batteries, and so they have a higher power density, but they're more expensive, and they're a hazardous material. So we only use those on specific missions when we need to go for extremely long periods of time. So we essentially adjust which battery pack we have depending on the mission. So we do a lot of flying for the state of New Jersey, which essentially we load up the glider with sensors to essentially look at water quality. And the state can't afford to be out there all the time on a ship, but it can afford to have essentially these glider robots do a full survey of the coastline of New Jersey. So they save a lot of money and get orders of magnitude more data than they would using traditional techniques. So that's only going to be essentially an alkaline battery. If we're out in the open ocean and it's going to be a long time to recovery, we'll switch to the more expensive lithiums, which can give us right now, our guess, depending on the sensor, is about almost a year at sea.
Wow.
And the data density is what's spectacular. So I'm part of a project in the Antarctic, and it's a time series project. I've been going down on ships for 19 years. And over that time, they've collected on the order of, I'd say, 5,000 profiles of the conditions using sort of shipboard techniques over that 19 years. We've deployed 4 gliders in that area over the last 2 to 3 years, and we've collected 50,000 profiles. Wow. So you get a whole different order of magnitude of data, so we can really resolve gradients we couldn't before. And that's why there's such a sort of rush by the scientific community to embrace these for oceanography.
Speaking of missions, one of your recently completed missions was the Scarlet Knight that... Well, maybe I'll let you tell us what it actually did and tell us maybe about this mission and why it's something so special.
Yeah, so the idea of the mission actually began a few years ago. Myself, Scott Glenn, and Josh Kohut, another professor in the lab, were at a meeting in Lithuania, and a very high-ranking person within the federal government here in the United States essentially sat us down and gave us a mission, which was to essentially inspire the next generation of engineers and scientists by exploring the ocean, because that's an exciting way to get them excited in technology. And then to demonstrate that you can go for long missions. And so he gave us this challenge, and it was kind of daunting, and we came back, and we had a relationship with a donor. And essentially, the donor liked the idea and essentially donated the money to do a long mission glider with these new experimental lithium batteries. So he donated the money to do this. And we built the Scarlet Knight. And the Scarlet Knight is essentially the mascot for Rutgers University, where I work. So the president of the university wanted to make sure he has branding on it. So that's why it's called the Scarlet Knight. And what the Scarlet Knight did, it essentially crossed the Atlantic Ocean. We launched it in April this year from off New Jersey, and it surfed the Gulf Stream. It navigated through large eddy fields past the Azores, and then in December was picked up with our Spanish partners in European waters. And so it's the first underwater robot to essentially cross an ocean basin on its own. And it was a demonstration. The technology now is available for us to essentially start building observing networks for large areas of the ocean, like the North Atlantic, the South Atlantic, the Antarctic, the Arctic, where we really need to get more data. And at the same time, it was a way to essentially entrain many, many undergraduates in the excitement of doing science. And so they were helping us pilot the glider. They helped construct all the data fields that helped us navigate and decide where to send the glider day to day. And so that glider essentially set the world's distance record and made it across the ocean. So it was a pretty exciting year, and it was a great way to end the year with success. And the glider was picked up and essentially made landfall in the town of Bayona, which was the Spanish town where Columbus's ship, the Pinta, returned to when it had discovered the New World. It was the first ship to make it to shore, bringing news of this new world. And so the town of Bayona hosted the celebration, ushering in a new era of ocean exploration with these ocean robots. And so it was a great success. And now our plan is to sort of start building out the global ocean system. And it'll be an international effort with many countries and many, many universities to essentially start constructing these robotic sensing networks so we can essentially understand where the ocean is today so we can make better predictions of where it's going to go tomorrow.
That's really an incredible mission. Congratulations.
Ah, thank you. No, it was very trying at times. We had tried the year before with a glider. It had made it all the way to the Azores to be essentially consumed by a shark.
I was just going to ask, actually, have you had any unexpected events or?
We have had shark attacks out in the open ocean and off Hawaii. We've flown about, I think right now we're up to 180 glider missions. And if you look at the distance traveled, we're getting close to 100,000 kilometers traveled underwater since late 2003. And the sharks are an issue. They tend to strike the gliders from below, and they're not that sturdy. They're designed to be relatively inexpensive. And so once a glider starts leaking, you have a very small window to recover it before King Neptune reclaims it to the bottom of the sea. The other thing that we hadn't expected is, you know, there's those fish, remoras, which are those sucker fish that'll attach to sharks. And so here we are in the lab, we're ballasting these robots, you know, down to sort of ounces. And then all of a sudden, occasionally these fish that weigh a pound and a half will attach themselves to the side of, the glider and essentially drive them into the seafloor. And, you know, the glider will panic essentially and initiate an escape behavior, and then we've got to go get it. The other one that actually the Scarlet Knight was impacted with was barnacles. Just like ships, you have barnacles over time attaching. And if you think of it from a barnacle's perspective, it is the perfect way to make a living. You have this robot carrying you up and down through the water at a relatively slow speed. You're on a fixed platform, and so the barnacles sort of spread out their feeding fans. And the problem is again, you've worked so hard to make this hydrodynamically sort of fit robot to get through the water, and now you're essentially attaching lots of mini sea anchors all over it. And so we still fight the same classical problems that have, you know, impacted mariners and boaters for centuries. So, yeah, we've had that. We've had occasionally humans are an issue. One good story was we were flying with some Australian colleagues off Perth. A glider was deployed. We got the first sort of call back, and it looked like it was near shore, but because of the time difference, it was the middle of our night, we were tired, we said we'd check it tomorrow. Well, we checked the next day, and yes, it was on land. In fact, it was sitting in a gentleman's front yard. We could essentially talk to the glider when it was sitting in his yard, so we could Google Earth it, we could find his house, we could turn sensors on and off. The neighbor looked over the fence. I guess he had picked it up. It had surfaced right by his boat. He thought, oh, this is cool, picked it up, was going to use it as a lawn ornament. It kind of looks like a cruise missile. So when the neighbor saw it and this big American flag on it, you know, her response was she was going to call the police. So we started getting updates from the glider again. It was on the highway heading back into Perth at this time, was dumped under some trees in the warehouse district, and left there. We could Google Earth it, give the latitude and longitude to our Australian colleagues. They went, they picked it up, dusted it off, threw it back in the water, and it completed its mission. So gliders are always exciting. We're still sort of getting a feel for all the unique things that we have to deal with we hadn't planned on.
Did you ever contact the person that tried to use your glider as a lawn ornament?
We sent a letter, you know, essentially a tongue-in-cheek letter. And most of the people in areas where the gliders fly a lot know about them and have learned to sort of just leave them be. What we were flying off Hawaii once in an area for a project, and it was near a coral reef where there was a lot of skin diving boats taking divers out. And so over a period of 10 days, the glider was rescued by well-meaning people 5 times, which meant that we had to go to the dive shop, pick it up, go back out that evening to redeploy it to continue sort of the science mission. But our hope is people will sort of start to understand what the gliders are doing and be able then to sort of just leave them be. You know, the cool room is pretty high visibility in our state. We get close to 250,000 web hits a day, and about 70% of the general public, and they access it for where do they want to go fishing, what beach do they want to go swimming at, what are the water conditions like, and all these types of things. And so, at least in our local area, most people who are out in the water know about us and so are actually very, very supportive.
So it seems, Oscar, that you think these gliders are going to be to stick around and to be used more and more. Where do you see the future of gliders in the ocean and their role in supporting our planet, I guess?
Yeah, I think that gliders and these kinds of technologies, ocean robotics, will fundamentally change how we study and interact with the oceans. We will be able to be in the ocean 24/7 anywhere in the world. The data will be live in the sense that we'll get it beamed to our computers. And so with the World Wide Web, we can access these systems via our iPhones, our portable PCs, and so we will essentially be able to populate the ocean with thousands of these gliders. They cost about, right now, maybe $100,000 a piece, but you have to think about that in terms of the daily cost of a ship being $20,000 a day. And so what I think the robots are going to do is they're going to be the big mappers of the ocean. They will map the ocean. They will map the chemistry, the physics, and biology of the ocean. So when we do go to sea as a scientist on a ship, we'll be using the ship, which is expensive and very flexible, to do experiments. And so these robots and the data will fill a critical gap, and so we are going to get much better predictions of where the ocean's going to go. And that's really critical for climate change questions. The ocean is really one of the big unknowns in sort of the rate of climate change and the potential changes associated with it. It'll have huge economic impacts. The maritime industry is a multi-trillion-dollar industry worldwide, and you know, the gliders will allow essentially those businesses to be more informed of the ocean they're operating in. And two, and finally, I think we need more scientists and engineers in the world. And I think sometimes science and engineering can come off a little dry, but I think oceanography sort of has sort of a pirate adventure aspect to it, and I think it'll be a great way to get the next generation of engineers excited in tackling these kinds of problems and becoming an engineer or scientist. So those are like the three big things I see coming out of it in the near future, in the next 10 years.
Thank you very much, Oscar, for being on Robots. We really appreciate your work.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
Mark Moline is professor at the Biological Sciences Department at the California Polytechnic State University. Still covered in snow after his latest expedition in the Arctic, Moline tells us about the challenges in using AUVs in freezing conditions and the technologies they had to develop to detect ice. He also gives us a biologist's perspective on how these new robotic tools are helping discover the secrets of life in the most unreachable places.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to Robots.
Hi, Sabine. How are you?
I'm good. And you?
I'm doing great. Got back from Europe, actually, and looking forward to talking to you about it.
Excellent. Can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Yeah, it's bizarre. I'm talking on a show about robots because I'm actually a biologist by training. And what I do is look at coastal ecosystems in the marine environment and look at how biology, how the food web functions in the ecosystem, and specifically looking at the smallest organisms that make up the food web, the small plants that fuel the food web. And part of my training, well, the core of my training has been looking at those types of questions, both in the temperate areas as well as the polar areas. And what I've done in the last 8 to 10 years is I realized when engineering teams were developing new underwater robotics that these would be excellent tools to better sample the kinds of organisms that I'm interested in. And so for the past 8 to 10 years, what I've been trying to do is basically teach myself engineering. And I've acquired a number of underwater robots to look at these distributions of organisms and develop new sensors for these platforms underwater. And so I guess if I was going to go back to school, I'd definitely take a few more engineering courses than I did when I was going through school. But it's a fun, exciting field, and every day I learn more and more about it.
That's funny because I did robotics and now I'm looking more into the biology field. So I guess that happens for everyone.
Yeah, I think it's good for everybody to sort of keep not get too comfortable in any one discipline, because I think the exciting science and engineering challenges are in those cross-disciplinary areas where you are sort of faced with these new challenges and you need to grab information and expertise from all different disciplines to make it work. I'm a faculty member here at California Polytechnic State University in San Luis Obispo, California, and I've been here for the past 11 years. Hard to believe it's been that long. It seems like it hasn't been that long. And I got my PhD from University of California in Santa Barbara and did a postdoc at Rutgers University in New Jersey. So that's my academic background.
You just came back from an expedition in the Arctic. Can you tell us what the goal of this mission was?
Yeah, so the goal of the mission, like I mentioned, it had a biology goal as well as an engineering goal to try and better sample the environment. The biology goal was to go into the Arctic in the middle of winter where there is no light and look at how organisms are functioning in the cold, dark winter. And the previous thought about that was that organisms were basically dormant. You know, there's no light. Everything goes to sleep. The system basically shuts down until the spring again. And what we found in our expedition was that it's absolutely the opposite of that. The underwater life is just abundant, and you know, organisms are mating, they're courting, they're laying eggs. Birds are flying around in the dark, foraging on the sea surface with really no light cues at all. It's pretty amazing. And we did our work up in northern Norway on the island group of Svalbard, and we went to a remote field camp called Ny-Ålesund, and we did our work there. On the robotic side of things, we brought our AUV tools up there. A collaborator here at Cal Poly, Christopher Clark, and I brought a number of robots, including a crawler, an ROV, and two AUVs, the underwater vehicles. And we used those vehicles in a number of different ways to assist the biology folks on discovering new things about the environment that they weren't able to do. And we used the vehicles sort of from an engineering standpoint, tried to better understand how to use these vehicles in that extreme cold environment as well as under ice environments. So we were restricted in when we could come up to the surface and retrieve them. So that was a challenge.
Can you present your AUV?
Yeah, so one of the AUVs that I use are the Remus vehicles. They're made by a company called Hydroid, and they're about 45 kilos. They have a diameter of about 25 centimeters, and they're about 2 meters long. And they are programmable, pre-programmable, and also programmable on the fly via wireless or via Iridium satellite. So once they're out, you can actually change their missions and so forth. The challenge for the typical vehicle like that is to get any of those communications, you have to come to the surface. And in the Arctic, that was a challenge because you could only come to the surface when there was no ice. And so what we were trying to do is develop the algorithms whereby the vehicle would know whether there's ice on the surface or not, and allow it to come out up or not. So that was one of the challenges. The other vehicle, the other AUV that we used was called an Iver 2. That's made by Ocean Server. And that is about 15 kilos. And again, wireless communication. And we have a dual PC stack in there, one where we're developing new algorithms for AUV flight control. So those were the two AUVs we used.
How do you actually detect ice?
We use an acoustic transponder. Basically, it's an upward-looking transponder. It sends an acoustic sound out and looks at the backscatter signal. And based on what's in the water, it reflects off of that in different ways. And the different types of ice, that was actually one of our challenges, was there's so many different types of ice that we needed to get those signals, those acoustic signals from those different types of ice for the intelligence that we were putting into the robots. We need to understand those different signals so that we can use those differently in the navigation programming that we're doing. And so basically sound, we shoot sound out and interpret that signal on the return signal. Yeah.
And are there any other challenges because of the cold, for example, on the sensors?
Yeah, so one of the once it's in the water, it's fine. So you deploy this, but if it has to come up repeatedly on the surface, what happens is ice builds up on the surface of the vehicle. And if there's anything protruding off the top, such as an antenna or so forth, ice accumulates at that and then changes the roll aspects of the vehicle. So we had to make sure that when we were deploying these, that once we put them in the water, we didn't take them out of the water or didn't come to the surface very often. So that was to avoid the ice, because the temperatures were about minus 30, and so any kind of sea spray, the vehicle moving through the water is generating some splash up onto these antennas, and it pretty much instantly freezes. And then it stays frozen once it goes back underwater. It increases the buoyancy of the vehicle a little bit too. So that was another challenge. So a lot of neat challenges, workarounds that we had to accommodate for in the environment.
You mentioned many robots, a couple scientists. What type of team does it take to conduct an Arctic mission?
Yeah, we had 17 people on our team, and we were probably on the engineering side and the robotic side, we had only four. So there were four of us trying to make sure all these robots were working for the scientists that were there, and that was kind of a challenge. But we were able to do some pretty neat things and discover especially how to detect these ice edges, the size of the ice from underneath, and basically how to incorporate that into navigation programming. So that was a big step forward. Another thing that we did, some of the biologists were diving in dry suits, and there was one species in particular that they wanted to get, and it was a pretty dangerous dive, and so instead of conducting that dangerous dive, we used the ROV to go down and actually do the sample collection. So that was another success in terms of being able to get a sample and not put any of the team members in danger, and use robots doing that.
How long were you there?
I was there a month. Yeah, just got back. Didn't see the sun for a month, so that was get up in the dark, go to bed in the dark, and that was interesting.
One thing I'm wondering is, with this ice everywhere, did you actually have to make holes so that the AUV could come?
Yeah,
up?
For some of these, we had to make holes, and then one of the challenges was some of these, both actually of the AUVs need some momentum to actually use to get control on the pitch fins on the back. You need water actually flowing over those, and to do that, you need speed, and to do that, you need some area on the surface. So that was a challenge in some respects. On occasion, we dipped it in by hand and then started it and made sure the proper revolutions were high enough and then let it go and sort of helped it along under the ice. But we got all our vehicles back, and so whenever we do that, we call it a success.
Can you maybe summarize some of the scientific results from your expeditions?
Yeah, so from the biology side of it, and you might be hearing some more about this in the future, because we have some other outlets that we're trying to share the scientific information with, is the abundance of the biology that was up there. So that was one of the biggest scientific sort of discoveries, was the intensity of biological activity at that time of year. From a robotic standpoint, there were a number of discoveries that we made, and that was, we had a number of different ice types that we were able to characterize with acoustics, and then we were able to use those in our programming algorithms for navigation. So when the vehicle would pass under ice, it would know whether there was ice on the surface or not. And that has two advantages, one for navigation, for deciding whether to come to the surface for any communications, and secondly, for the biological sampling. We're attaching cameras to these AUVs and taking pictures of the biology on the underside of these ice floes. And so if we know there's ice, we can activate these cameras and do underwater sort of inverse mosaics of what the under ice looks like and what kind of organisms are living there.
What kind of organisms?
So there are small plants that live in the sea ice, and not at this time of year, of course. They're in very low abundance because there's no light. but primarily amphipods, which are these small crustaceans that live there, and then there's the Arctic cod, which uses it mostly as a protective defense against other predators like seals and things. They hide in these cracks in the ice, and then the seals can't get to them, and so they use these as protective structures. And so one of the things that your audience might not know is how complicated they think might think that ice is simply flat, but what happens is ice bangs into each, these flows bang into each other and raft on top of each other. And so when they do that, they push pieces down and some go up. And so the underside of the ice is actually a very complex puzzle for these AUVs to fly under. And they use this acoustic pinger off the bottom of the ice as an altimeter as well, so they can avoid hitting any ice that's submerged deep. And these ice formations can extend down 15 meters below the surface. So it's like flying upside down on a complex terrain, terrestrial terrain.
I know people are monitoring ice basically to see to get information about global warming. Do you think you could use this AOV with this ice characterization to maybe?
Yeah, that's one of our big focus areas. You know, this expedition was going out and, you know, basically asking the question, can we do these? Can we use these robots in this environment? And the answer we got from this is yes. The next step is to take them. We have a cruise that's going up in May and again in September to actually implement some of the code and some of the what we've learned on this recent expedition in a real-life situation. So we're going to head up into the pack ice of the Arctic. And one of the changes that's occurring in the Arctic is that the amount of what's called multi-year ice is diminishing. This is ice that stays around during the summer and then is refreezes and then a new layer forms. And so there's multi-year ice used to be a very common thing in the entire Arctic, and now it's restricted to Northern Greenland, Northern Canada area, and there's not much of this multi-year ice. So what we're trying to do is use these robots under multi-year ice, which actually has a very complex underwater topography, and look at the difference between multi-year ice and annual ice, which is the ice that just forms once a year and then melts, and look at the difference in the structure of the food webs, the biology in those two groups. And so the climate change is actually affecting the amount of multi-year ice, and that might be a very important source of food for some of the higher apex predators like seals and whales and polar bears.
And generally, what other research questions are you looking at with your AUVs?
In general, other than the polar regions, actually, I'm hoping to move to the other side of the globe and work again. I did some of my previous work in Antarctica and bring the robots down there and look at some of the foraging areas that penguins use. So they go out, and when they have a chick in their nest, they go about 20 kilometers offshore and they feed off the offshore and then come back. And nobody knows much about their what they're actually feeding on, how they're feeding, etc. And so what we plan to do is tag some of these birds so we know where they are, and use their locations to direct these AUVs towards the location and define their habitat that they're foraging in. So use that as a real-time kind of system where the birds are telling the AUVs essentially where to go and sample. So pretty exciting stuff. And then just locally off the coast of California here, we use these vehicles for mapping estuaries, mapping the bottom kelp forests. We look at just general oceanography, look at the influence of El Nino events on the California coast and look at the propagation of warmer water coming up the coastline. So these are becoming much more usable tools to scientists, and engineers are still in the background improving these things, but they've done such a great job in the past 15 years to move these tools into the hands of scientists, so that we can actually use them and gain new knowledge on how the ocean itself works.
Final question: how do you see the future of underwater robotics in general?
Well, I just alluded to it a little bit, but I think that the number of vehicles that are out there that are is only going to increase. Ships are very expensive to operate. You have a crew, and they're very expensive. And a lot of what they do can be done by these. They're not going to replace ships, but a lot of what the robots can do, a lot of what the ships can do, robots can do, and they can stay out there for a much longer period of time. Some of these glider systems are able to stay out for almost a year, and these AUVs are able to sample in a way that you can't from a ship. They, you know, you can do level flight, you can undulate through the water column, you can terrain hug when you're navigating, and so sampling like that is not conducive to a ship. Some of those you actually can't do on a ship, and so I just think they're going to continue to grow. One of the really exciting things is sort of the sustained observatories that are being built out. There's a system in Canada right now, and the U.S. is building one. Europe's building one as well, where underwater cables will provide power and data connectivity between these underwater systems, and basically they'll come and dock in with these underwater cables. They'll get repowered and download their information and then get sent on the new mission. And so I think a lot of the future is going to be the sustained observations of the ocean on really large scale. So we'll better understand how things like climate change are really affecting the ocean.
Thanks, Mark, for being here with us on Robots.
Yeah, nice to talk to you, Sabine.
Before we wrap up, let's continue our discussion on what is a robot. Thanks to all of you who sent their definitions to us, we haven't received two alike so far. Our first definition comes from Kevin MacIce in the U.S.
Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Robots.
Hi. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Can you present yourself to our listeners?
I'm a PhD student at Indiana University School of Informatics and Computing, and my dissertation topic has to deal with social robotics and designing for that area.
You were the first one to come up with a definition of what is a robot, so can you please give us your definition?
Okay, I looked at Wikipedia first, so just an idea of the common stuff as a starting ground, and this is what I came up with, that a robot is a physical machine manipulated to automatically perform an undesirable work function that supports a desired human outcome.
Okay, do you think there's a counterexample?
Well, in talking with my advisor, I think that it's just a starting point, and that the interesting part of this definition is the undesirable work versus desired human outcome. And that's actually what I'm focusing on right now is investigating that. So there's the problem with defining robots, of course, is that everybody has their own conception of what it's there for and what is the constraints about it. And this is just one attempt to get a lay of the land to get a starting point.
Okay, excellent. Thanks a lot, Kevin, for your definition on robots.
Okay, thanks so much.
An undesirable work function. I think that Kevin's definition is a really good starting point for our debate, and that definitions will inevitably depend on each and everyone's own interests. As promised, though, we've been looking for counterexamples that either fit the definition but are not a robot, or that don't fit the definition even though they should be considered as robots. After some brainstorming and, frankly, a bit of struggle, here is our conclusion. Our feeling is that art and entertainment robots, or robots which don't have a clear purpose, do not fill an undesirable work function that supports a desired human outcome. As examples, we have the Pleos, Sony's Aibo, and Theo Janssen's giant roaming creatures. A couple months back, there was also this tiny robot asking humans for directions in Central Park, which wasn't really that useful. Finally, robots have also been used as tools for researchers to understand biology, for example. However, these robots are not really accomplishing an undesirable work function. I also took the good old calculator example. A calculator is a physical machine that is manipulated, right? Humans have to press the buttons, to automatically perform an undesirable work function. Here, it's calculating 2 plus 2, that supports a desired human outcome, which in this case would be 4. Okay, so let's keep trying towards our holy grail definition, and we hope you'll keep your definitions coming at info@robotspodcast.com.
And that wraps up yet another episode of Robots. For more information on today's guests, visit our website at www.robotspodcast.com.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Traverse the Seas with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.